everybody.
Blog Talk.
When a parent lashes out at the other parent in front of a child, or simply says hurtful things about the other parent in front of a child, they are also attacking that child's sense of self-worth and confidence. This is an act of alienation and is harmful to children and can cause a lifetime of issues for the child. Issues as serious as anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and thoughts of or actual suicide. Help spread the word. Visit www.paawareness.org.
And that's what you need to do. Spread the word. This is Jill Ajizi, and I welcome you all to Family Matters with my wonderful, beautiful co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence. But listen, creating awareness and educating people about the devastating effects and behaviors of parental alienation is what we need to be doing all across this nation, North America, all around the world. So please, I know you're listening all around the world tonight. Make that call to someone who doesn't know what parental alienation is, and let's get this stopped. Judge Michelle, how are
you? Hi there. Hi, Jill. And tonight's going to be an interesting branch of the tree of what happens in this vicious and hostile cycle. And I'm really interested in what we're talking about tonight, because this is a piece of the parent alienation puzzle that we're going to completely focus on tonight. And I'm really happy about that. Why don't you introduce our guest
I want to tell you how I came to know Susan, Dr. Weitzman. I was watching 6 years ago when I started my journey of parental alienation. I was watching the Oprah Winfrey Show one day, and I saw Dr. Weitzman on the show. Found out she was in Chicago. I'm in Illinois. I made the call. I'm from Chicago. Love that town. And I thought, any excuse I have to go from our capital to Chicago, I'm going to do it. And this is something that's really going to make a difference in my life. So I went to talk to Susan, and what she does is so incredibly interesting, because it's an underserved population that everybody forgets about. This is, and I'm on the board now, which is so exciting, of the Weitzman Center, which is her baby, and she'll tell us about that later. But what she is doing is serving a population that goes unserved, really, and is a forgotten population. And I went to her because I was experiencing verbal and emotional abuse in my marriage and was frightened to tell anybody about what was going on. And that happens with so many people in my situation. And then parental alienation is all part of that, and it's all rolled into one. So I want to welcome Dr. Susan Weitzman. Thank you for being here tonight, Susan.
Hey, I'm excited to be on your show.
And we've had a lot of interaction in the last few months with the Weitzman Center, which we'll talk about in a little while. But I want you to tell us what made you get into this field and why you're working with this particular population of women and some men.
Right. And men, yeah. But the population you're really talking about that I ended up doing research on and uncovering, in a sense, is, and this is the bad word that we can't get another good word for, I'd call it upscale violence as it relates to an upscale population. But to unpack that, basically upscale, the population are people who are middle, upper class, or upper educated, meaning college and above degree. So people who you don't necessarily assume, when they tell you that there's marital difficulties, you don't assume or ask, are you getting beaten? You know, are you getting emotionally abused in any way? And how that started for me, the watershed moment for me, I was on staff at the University of Chicago in the Department of Psychiatry, and I tended to treat a lot of the professors and their wives and the doctors and their wives. And I met a woman who came in for marital counseling. I did marital counseling with her and her husband. They were both fairly well known in their fields. And we completed the work, and that was it. And then a few months later, she became pregnant, an unplanned pregnancy, and came back to me and revealed in a session all the physical and emotional abuse her husband had been subjecting her to, as well as impacting her children. And there was a lot of parental alienation going on in that situation as well. And what was shocking about it was I was a really very competent diagnostician, and I knew about abuse. It never even crossed my mind to ask them if that was taking place, because it was an assumption almost, an unspoken assumption. It doesn't happen to people like us. Anyway, we did work on
that.
There
was no tell in the therapy?
No.
Overbearing or...
Not at all.
Interesting.
Congenial, intelligent, well-spoken, polite with each other. No tell at all. And I was one of those obsessive types where I always looked under every rock. No tell at all. So that made me think, well, now, wait a minute. Is it that it's not happening in this population, or are they not reporting it? So I started researching it, and when I looked into the research to date, which, by the way, any real research about domestic abuse didn't really hit the headlines in any way till the 60s. And it got tagged on to the rape hotlines. That's how it even came into the light of day. But women have been abused for centuries. And if you read the book, there's one chapter all about the history of abuse and how it's been overlooked and how men have been getting off with sending flowers after breaking someone's teeth, et cetera, et cetera. Anyhow, so I researched it, and the research said domestic abuse crosses all economic statuses and religion, and it just crosses across the cultural spectrum. But if you look at who they did the research on, it was lower income women who went to the shelters, who went to the emergency rooms, where their numbers could be seen and counted. So this is similar to how they early on were doing research on breast cancer. They did research on breast cancer on middle-aged white males. Did you know that? They weren't doing it on women. So even though they got the research out of it on domestic abuse, they really weren't seeing these people. So I decided to see what I could do, and then I realized that I was basically looking for unicorns, because this is a population that doesn't speak, that has what I refer to. My book is called Not to People Like Us, Hidden Abuse in Upscale Marriages. And what I refer to is the veil of silence over this population. And we could talk about how parental alienation very well fits into that and under that. But so I started researching it, and I went in looking to see if there were patterns. And in fact, there were certain patterns and idiosyncratic kinds of ways this unfolded.
Well, what are the were the patterns?
Yeah, the whole book is about the patterns of getting in, staying in, and getting out, and how they're fairly unique to this population. But for instance, most of these women, and this has been fleshed out over the years since the book, with clinical observations by myself and my colleagues, as well as, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of letters I get from people saying your book basically narrated my life. So for one thing, these women did not typically grow up with this. They didn't have abuse or emotional abuse in their families and their backgrounds. So when it happened to them, they didn't even call it that. They would make excuses, what I call justification by explanation. They would say, oh, he's an executive, he's having a bad day, or, you know, he gets moody, I have to... They would tiptoe around it, and because they themselves tended to be go-getter kind of women. You're a great example. I mean, they were used to making things happen. So when something wasn't working,
The difference between that and lower socioeconomic in terms of
So when something wasn't working in their marriage, they would double their efforts to fix it. Now, because and here is the beginning of answering the question, how is it different? Because their belief was it doesn't happen to people, it shouldn't happen to me. I'm a lawyer. It shouldn't happen to me. I'm a doctor. It shouldn't happen. It probably doesn't happen to other people. They have a self-imposed silence about it. They don't realize it might be happening to their neighbor in her 12-bedroom house, too, because no one's talking about it. So that's one key difference, is there's a heavier kind of veil of silence about it. When these women eventually do try to come out about it, and it is a coming out, they tend to be disbelieved, whereas if a lower-income person, let's say, goes to the emergency room with a broken arm, they're not going to be afraid to ask her, how did this happen? You have a doctor.
Because
go to an
Susan, very often, isn't it these same women who maybe were delivering meals to the local women's shelter or taking coats for the children that live there that now would need help, and when they come, they're not taken seriously, and they are turned away by battered women's shelters. So that was the the sort of birth of the Weizmann Center, because you wanted to have a place where women like me at that point could go and feel comfortable in expressing what was happening within their marriage and,
exactly.
And after the divorce.
Exactly. And the disbelief, how it manifested, at least even early on in the study, family members would say, what are you complaining about? You live in a mansion. Or what are you complaining about? You're both PhDs who write amazing articles. There was disbelief from the family support network. I have examples that would make your hair stand up of people going to therapy.
I want to stop you for 1 second on this. So if their neighbors, obviously higher socioeconomic status of the stratosphere of the population as well, are saying that they're buying into, if you have money, that's enough? You're saying that that's the mentality? As long as you have a big mansion,
that
should
really
be enough for you?
No, but that is, well, it depends. It depends. The first mentality is this doesn't happen to people like us. So when it occurs, there's a great deal of shame and fear of coming out about it, being ostracized in your community. And you find this in various cultural communities as well. Orthodox Jews, if you come out about being abused, you get ostracized oftentimes from your community. You see this in the Indian communities as well. No, I don't think there's a belief that money does it all, but I think that within the people that they may turn to, there may be a sense that, what are you really complaining about? Because they don't come out and say, look, he broke my arm. Okay. They may say, look, I've been feeling this is going on in my marriage. They take little trial balloons about how it's going to be received, and the response usually is, oh, go get a facial, you know, not that
well,
you
Susan,
have it because
Susan,
of money.
I have to because I lived it. I have to disagree with you on the fact that people do believe that money does it all. They believe that if you have the things that you have and you live the way that you live, which is exactly why I named my book, the novel, The Look of Love, because they believe that what you are living and what you have and what you are and the being that you put out there is what is real, and that you should be happy with what you have. And I think it really stems from jealousy.
Well, I'm not saying that they don't think that, and I don't know what the they we're talking about really consists of, but I do know that there's a disbelief reaction. Part of it may be what you're saying, that there is a belief you've got the finances, so what are you worried about? But I also think, the word jealousy, I would call it envy. I think because
envy,
people,
envy is a good word, better word.
Because people are living an enviable lifestyle. So I don't know if it's exactly that money does it all, but they're living it what looks like an enviable lifestyle.
Well, I think
so
and then
the
it's added to, but this is added to by the ex-spouse or soon-to-be ex-spouse that tells these people, and when I'm speaking of this, I'm talking of a church that I attended for 21 years and we were very good to the church, gave a lot of money to the church. People thought that we had lots of money, and what he led them then to believe was she had everything, she just couldn't be happy no matter what that was. And then that began the snowball that ended up in parental alienation.
Well, Jill,
because
your church experience, because that was a money-driven thing, and that's pretty interesting, how the church turned its back on you.
Well, and Michelle, that's not uncommon. I mean, I talk to people all day long that have been, you know, proud members of these churches. And these are Pentecostal churches. And I know it happens in all, but I find it more when I'm talking to people about the Pentecostal church that they immediately draw a line in the sand and they choose the person that they want to believe. And most oftentimes that ends up being, because I deal with alienated parents so much, the alienator. And so I was
I can speak to that with the first example I gave and flesh that out a little. When some of the women I've worked with or interviewed have gone to their families and said, look, this isn't working, or they do these trial balloons. They don't come right out and say, he's, you know, tying me up or whatever. And the family says, what have you got to complain about? In many cases, the family is benefiting. There are perks used to being the father-in-law or the sister-in-law to a powerful man, many of them financial. So they don't want to rock the boat either, and they might take a very blind eye to it, and that has a financial component. I remember when I started the Abuse Awareness League was the first version, the 1.0 version of Weitzman Center. When I started that, one of the people on the board of that organization was a very well-known gynecologist, an obstetrician gynecologist in Chicago. And I asked him, I said, now, do you typically ask women in your office, if they come in with any kind of physical scar, do you ask them if something was going on at home? Now, this is many years ago. Thank goodness it's changing now, and it is more popular to ask. But he said, well, you know, I know these women very well, and I'm sure they would tell me, and I really don't want to ruffle them in any way or make them embarrassed. What he was also saying was he had a Michigan Avenue practice, and he didn't want to lose a connection with some of the population he was treating. It was very much financially driven, I believe.
But that's changed a lot, hasn't it?
It's changed an enormous amount. When I started doing this, they wouldn't even ask in emergency rooms. There's an example in the first chapter of my book, where a doctor did go to an emergency room with a lacerated arm from a glass tabletop her husband had hit her with. And when she went in there, and some of them knew her, and they said, what happened? And she came up with a very flimsy excuse. They never challenged it. Now that doesn't happen anymore. If you go through an ER, there's protocol. No matter who you are, it does get addressed. Thank goodness that's changing. But in terms
what
of parental alien... Okay, go ahead.
What about the abuse of men in the upper populations, in the upper...
I haven't studied it, but I have worked with some abused men, and some of it's physical, and some of it's emotional, and that's a whole nother shame factor, because no matter what population you're in, I don't think any man would want to come out about being beaten by his woman. It's a whole
different... Whoa, I see it in my court a lot.
Yeah.
But, Susan, isn't it important to point out this just isn't physical abuse?
No,
I experienced very little physical abuse, but
right.
Emotional and verbal abuse was intense and daily.
And you see it continue in the court cases. Oftentimes, a lot of these people will wage frivolous lawsuits and drain the partner, more often women than not, but drain the woman of her finances where she has to fight back. And I know there are some laws they're working on about leveling the playing field, but the court...
Oh, no, it's not. It's real laws about leveling the playing field. Let's say you have an upscale family,
mm-hmm.
and you have an abusive wife or husband. Let's just say an abusive husband for the
mm-hmm.
moment. And she wants to get out, and she goes to court.
Mm-hmm.
She files for divorce, and there's a lot of money. That lawyer's going to get some money to pay the lawyer. She's going to get some money to pay her own lawyer. If the guy goes and gets a lawyer, and he gives the lawyer $10,000, she has the right to the same amount. So this leveling the playing field thing is very real.
That
it's
is
not
but
something
isn't,
out there.
But someone can keep waging frivolous lawsuits, correct? And then I oftentimes see the
yeah, but you
battle.
Can't. You know what, Dr. Weitzman, you can't get away with it. So, you know, not for a while now.
Uh-huh.
Not since they passed the leveling the playing field, which a judge can order pretty much on what's called on a summary basis. That means
right,
without
right.
taking a lot of evidence about needs. And,
right.
and if the money's there, it can be spent on
right.
defending somebody with the have-not.
Right, but what I've seen a lot is the custody issue. A lot of times there'll be custody battles, even if the guy doesn't want custody. It's just another form of abuse.
Well, that's another top. That's another
right.
truth.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And, that's another very real
brutal
truth in our process.
Well, right, but there's many, many women who have lost custody of their children because the guys have waged these amazing battles with these dream teams of lawyers. I did a case in Washington where that happened. The guy literally brought 7 attorneys with him, and I couldn't. The only thing they didn't object to my saying was my name. I mean, it was just...
Oh,
it,
my. Oh, yeah, it does
tense.
Happen, of course.
It happens. So now in terms of parental alienation, what you often see in the situation where there is that financial piece, many times you see examples of men threatening to cut the children off financially if the woman goes forward with coming out about it. And then they talk to the children, well, I'm not sending you here because of your mother. And that's very much a form of parental alienating.
Well, yeah, think of a trick bag. You're putting the person in.
Exactly.
By making her turn her back on her children to protect herself. Talk about
it. Turn her back on herself to protect her children.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and that happens all. I just had a case today that exactly happened. And what happened was the woman's son stopped talking to her. He was losing out a lot because she was speaking up. And this is a guy who loved his mom. So, I mean, it has its own unique kind of texture.
I talked to those same five people today. You know, it happens so often, you know, and I could talk to people. I said to someone today, I want to put a bill in the Illinois legislature that is going to increase the day to 48 hours instead of 24, because there are so many people having this problem. And I love it that Michelle is so idealistic in her views that, you know, you can go into court and there's laws to make these things happen. But unless you've got a judge like Michelle, it's just you get swept under the rug. A mother who was a housewife is undervalued in America today. And unfortunately, that was the most important job when our mothers were kids. And now it's very undervalued. And I feel very sorry for some of these women that this is happening to, and men. I want to take a call from area code 217 that we have. Ruthie, can you put that call on for us?
It sounds like Indiana 217.
Welcome, area code 217.
Hi, Jill. I have a question. Is it better to have a commitment to family and stay in a dysfunctional marriage, or to relieve your stress and get out, raise your children in a healthy co-parenting scenario?
Susan, do you want to address that?
You know, it's the backward crystal ball here. It's a good question.
I will address it, too. If
Yeah, no, I'm glad to address it.
Sure, Carol,
yeah,
we'll let you hang up.
What?
Pardon me?
We'll let area code 217 hang up, and let's have Dr. Weissman and Judge Michelle address your question.
Okay. On first blush, the answer would be, of course, it's better to get out of a severely dysfunctional situation, because staying in is teaching your children that this is how relationships are, that how that person is treating you is okay. It's serving as a modeling base for them that is really going to ruin their future relationships. So on first blush, that would be the answer. However, there are cases where if you watch the hell that people have gone through, I've been in cases where the court cases have gone on for 12 years, oftentimes people would say, gee, I should have just stayed, figured out my own life somehow, and made it work. It would have been easier. But, you know, from a mental health perspective, one would have to say, of course, you get out of a situation where your physical or emotional well-being is so threatened, because what that's doing to your children is not healthy. So what do you
Michelle?
Think? So I want to answer this very, very carefully. It may always be better for the person who's unhappy and being abused to get out. That may always be true. It is not always true that it's better for the children. That's a very nuanced answer. That has everything to do, depending upon what kind of conflict they are observing. If they are observing conflict from a dysfunctional family, and this is highly generalized answer, it's the only way you can do it, so it's subject to all kinds of exceptions. But if they are viewing conflict and arguing, and they're watching their parents work through it, then they may very well be learning adversity and conflict skills, and find that even if there's conflict in your life doesn't blow up. Because what children learn when they see conflict, and it's a divorce, it's conflict happened, your life blew up, and as you become risk-adverse, conflict-adverse for the rest of your life. It depends upon what they're viewing. If the dysfunction is so brutal, it depends upon the level of it. And that's always going to be the hard thing. It's not true to always stay together for the kids. It depends upon what they're learning. So
I think we're
real hard one to answer.
If
there's physical abuse, I think that's not hard to answer at all.
Right.
I think there's no way they should ever see that,
but
they should ever be
abuse,
in a household of that.
Well, exactly. But with emotional abuse, again, it, like you said, it depending on what they're witnessing. If they're watching the mother be disabled emotionally, crippled emotionally, you know, bullied and belittled in public by the spouse, I think that is a bad lesson for them to take in. And
don't you think, Susan, so often, though, these women, and I know I felt this way, that there was that desire to sort of safeguard the ideal of what a family was in your head. And
sure.
You continually try to make it better. You try to, like you said earlier, make excuses for what's going on so that it can be that idealistic vision of what you were when you're 19, the white dress, the cake, the car, the dog, the whole darn thing, as the country song says. You know, you want it to be absolutely perfect for your children. And to say over and over to yourself that I'm going to stay until this child or these children are out of high school and then I'll deal with it is something that you hear so often.
Well, that's
and,
what I've heard.
And,
that's
and
what I've
Jill,
heard.
And Jill, it is on some, you know, people ask me all the time, what's the best age? I want to leave my husband. I want to leave my wife. What's the least damaging age? And Dr. Weissman, I bet you get that question a lot, too.
All the time.
And there, you know, there are some answers to that, but that's a whole other show. But but the thing, you know, it really is. But the thing,
well,
to, you know, that you have to remember is that the studies show that even an arguing, combative family intact is better for the children. Depends upon the kind of arguing. It depends upon the resolution.
Well, but
depends
let me counter that.
Sadly,
just...
it's true that staying together, by and large, is better for the children. But then again, quality of life for the one who,
right.
for the adults.
Right.
The moral dilemma. Who said it was easy?
Well, but I have
it's
people
really
come
hard.
To me. But I have people come to me as adults who say retrospectively, I wish my parents had separated. So it's very hard to – it really depends on where you are in the narrative. I mean, if you're looking back on it or if you're in it. The families I work with who are going through divorce, and I do a lot of litigation consulting with cases, the families are ripped apart. It's horrible. And in those cases, women say things like, should I have just looked the other way and stayed? And then you mentioned if they learn how to resolve the conflict, then it's a positive, teachable thing. I agree, but most of these cases, they aren't resolving it in a way that's positive.
Well, ultimately, the ones that come before us, for sure.
Yeah, right.
But,
exactly.
You know, there's just, you know, the answers are like the Roy G. Biv scale all the way
across
the board. I'd like to ask you a question a little bit about, since I am
trying
to...
Let me just add one thing before you... I cannot tell you how many people have this posed to them by their spouses. I will stay with you. Nothing will get disrupted. Your insurance, your lifestyle, everything. But I'm going to keep having my affair.
Oh, you're talking about me. Are you telling my story again?
No, I sure am not.
Come on.
I sure am not. I cannot tell you how many times in a month I hear that. And pause and think for a minute.
It's been a lifestyle for people for a long time, since, you know, the beginning of time.
Well, some countries have. You have a wife and you have a mistress, sure.
It still exists if you have the, especially if you have the money for it.
Right.
But you're dealing with these narcissistic, selfish people that they want their cake, they want to eat it too, they want to have everything that they want. And, in my case, this is weird, and the people that have read the book know this, but I had a secret divorce, couldn't tell anybody. And then I could keep everything that I had. I could maintain my social status and my financial status if I was quiet because he didn't want it in the paper. Mm-hmm. That's insane. Why would somebody do that? And it just shows you. I mean, people that know me now would say, what on earth were you thinking? What were you thinking? But you are controlled, just like eventually your children become controlled. And it's just a horrible position to be in. You're torn between trying to save your children and trying to save yourself. And ultimately, you give yourself up.
So I
and
like.
I don't know. I don't know. Did you? If you did, anyone happen to see the 2020 show that they did on Lots of People Like Us? They did. This was Cynthia McFadden, They opened it up with a woman who they caught. They literally videotaped as she was leaving. And when they interviewed her and they said, what was the turning point moment for you? She said, it happened one Christmas. My husband said I had decorated the house too much, and he got angry with me. And my son says, why don't you just hit her like you did in the car, and maybe she'll stop? The son, the little 8-year-old, said that to the father.
Yeah, that's right.
And when she heard that, she was out. She said, I can't let him learn this. I can't let him see his mother this way.
Well,
it's
bravo
cold.
For her, Dr. Weitzman, because, you know, a lot of people just are
the other way.
A lot of people are too terrified
to
keep that from. This is the heartbreaking part of the whole topic that each one of us is involved with in our own unique ways. This is the heartbreaking thing, when people are too frightened to leave, even though they're, this little boy is going to, you know, prone to being a bully,
absolutely,
prone to thinking that aggression and hostility is the choice on the menu for him,
mm-hmm,
to get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really sad. I like to, because this is sort of a parent alienation show, I like to profile a little. And because I am a crime scene CSI Miami wannabe, tell us a little bit about the profile of an upper class abuser. Is it the same as somebody who would you make distinctions about that?
There are some distinctions in, you know, I don't have my book right in front of me right now. How about that? But in the back of my book, there are all these, there are appendices.
Paraphrase yourself.
I will. I think I know it well enough by now. But there are appendices, profile of the F-scale abused woman, profile of early warning signs that are ignored, profile of the guy. So you tend to see, prior to my work, the researchers, the people who wrote about this, tended to depict the guy as either being sociopathic, antisocial personality, or borderline personality. And what I found through all the work I've done over the years is that they tended to be narcissistic personality disordered, okay, which, you know, is a different kind of a psychiatric diagnosis. But in terms of qualities and how they act, if you look at the early warning signs, I don't know if it's different. Some of this is for all abusers, not just for this population. But you can see early on how did, and I teach this to people too, is to honor the early warning signs. How does this dating partner treat waitresses? How do they act, you know, people who work for them? How do they act with animals? You see this in little kids early on when they start being vilely, you know, very abusive to little animals, anything helpless or smaller than. But you also see certain ways of interfacing, using sex as a weapon and a punishment, withholding sex, belittling in public, using put-down humor. And then there's the whole interface of expecting to get their needs met. Some of these guys who are narcissistic personality disorders do believe that everything focuses around them and their needs and wants, and expects people who are connected with them to know those needs and wants and meet them, even if they are unspoken. When that doesn't happen, that stirs up a feeling in the guy of inadequacy, and that leads to a narcissistic rage. The only way that can get relieved is by explosion, whether it's physical, verbal, whatever, but that has that release factor in it. And then the other piece that's unique, too, is they really can be above the law. They believe they're above the law, and they can be above the law. And you know, they have the ability. Look at the O.J. Simpson case, which happened before. I started my research before that happened. But, you know, he really did get away with what most people believe was murder. And, you know, there's many cases like that we could cite that I'm sure Judge Lawrence knows more of than I do. But they really can be above the law. And so that's a sense of entitlement that does run through this personality. Can you attest to that, Jill?
So is there such a thing, dare I say, is there such a thing as, could we have listeners out there who are not prepared to leave yet, for whatever reason, not judging it at all, Is there anything they could do if they're in an abusive environment to protect their children other than leaving?
Protect their children.
Yes, to protect their children from, yes, that's
protect their children from being abused, or protect their children. Depends what you're. In most of the cases I've studied, the men were not.
Protect their children from witnessing the environment.
Oh, from witnessing.
What if the children see it? I mean, what can
right.
they do if they choose to stay?
Okay. First off, I do want to indicate that in most of the cases I studied, the men were not actually abusive to their children. It was solely dedicated to the partner.
I understand that.
Maybe because
so I didn't mean
were extensions of themselves,
that.
And that's why, or whatever. Once the cat's out of the bag, I mean, once they've seen it, how can they protect them? I think children see things even when you think they're not.
Sure.
So, you know, I don't think there's a good way to protect the children from it if it's in the environment. I would have to think about that some more and give you a more nuanced answer, but I think if it's there, the children are going to see it. You could, I guess, make excuses and explain to the children why you're staying, but then that's getting them involved on a level children don't need to be involved at.
What if they're already involved, which you've got to imagine they are?
Well, then the mother needs to be in some counseling to really figure out why she's staying. I know statistically it's not unusual for people to make at least 5 to 7 attempts before they finally leave, where they leave, they come back, they leave, they reconcile, they leave. So, you know, there is that period. But, you know, if you hear children talk about it from the mouths of babes, I mean, they will say, I don't know what daddy's doing to mommy. I don't know why she doesn't walk away. I've heard this from little kids I've interviewed.
Susan,
so
I know that the people that I talk with, and I want to know if you find this with the people that you see in your office, they will often say that the alienation process has begun before they ever decide to leave the house. They are being alienated from their children in an intact marriage. So what I guess Michelle. Yeah, of course. And so Michelle's asking, how do you protect the children? But what I'd like to know is,
I guess
if
I don't
a woman,
think you do. I guess I don't think you
yeah,
do.
I know you don't. You know, and that's what I'm trying to say is, if some of these kids are already on board with what's going on and they've moved sort of to the other side depending on their age, and if you've got an adolescent 13 to 18, there's a pretty good chance, if there's money involved, that child is already going to be on the alienation bandwagon and moving towards, you know, their new Range Rover or American Express card.
Right.
So that's a big carrot to a kid. And to say that, you know, I'll get you this if you don't do this with your mom, or if you don't talk to your mom, or if you call your mom a name, or call your mom by her first name. There's all of those things that go along with it. So what does a woman do?
Let's soften it to even less than those overt ways. I see instances where the alienation is so insidious and subtle. For instance, the mother will finally be exploding and saying, you can't do this to me. Right, the children are around, they're hearing it or whatever, they're seeing it, she's taking a stand, and the father will suddenly have a very soft, calm voice. Boy, mommy's so excited. You know, do this crazy-making gaslighting. So this is confusing to the child. You put a little child with not the kind of adult resources mentally that we have, they don't know what to do with that conflict. They love both parents. But they start to buy into the softer voice who's saying,
right.
Well, why is mommy so upset?
That's and all
of
that
of
really, that's a really a premeditated game plan.
Absolutely.
To make, you know, to make, and all done in a football playbook, to make that person look like they are not quite right to the children, and then later to present that in court
fashion. What? A lot of the work I do with women when I do litigation work is I help the lawyers get the woman in shape to take the stand. Because oftentimes the crazy-making, gaslighting behavior, she becomes what I call in my book husband-fulfilling prophecy. She becomes what he accuses her of being. There's a lot of crazy-making that goes on. I hear this every day in my practice.
Well, I think
yes,
you begin
I would say
to
it
second
is premeditated.
Guess. You begin to second-guess yourself, and you begin
Absolutely.
To believe some of the things that
right.
are being told to you on a continuous basis. So
right.
so you just become that person. You're absolutely right. But if
what
there's
chance,
someone,
wait, if you start buying into it, what chance does a little kid have but to buy into it? Think about
you're
it.
You're right. Michelle, you're off quiet.
Michelle's question is a great question. I don't have a good answer. I don't think you
can. I have another more difficult question, even. But I have to ask it. I have to ask it. When you see these signs that you talked about a few minutes ago, you know, mean to animals,
right,
these early signs, and you're in a marriage and you just saw your spouse kick the cat,
mm-hmm.
Is there anything that a spouse can do to reverse it early on before it degenerates all out?
First of all, the signs come up during dating. The signs come up on the honeymoon. The signs don't just suddenly erupt typically in the marriage, because people telegraph who they are with everything they say and everything they do. And it's just a matter of how are you listening, okay? And that's what I try to teach in my healing retreat weekends. That's what I do. I teach how to tune into yourself and turn onto those signs. So if you see it, as you say, that they're suddenly doing this, can you put the brakes on? You can't put the brakes on, but what you can do is you can establish boundaries, and you can have consequences to that behavior. And then you put those boundaries there, you put the consequences out, and then you watch how the guy responds. If you say, look, you can't do this, this is unacceptable for me, watch what he does. And then you see if the behavior is malleable, if it's changeable. You'll know right away. Odds are probably not.
Susan, what would you say to someone, some young woman or some 40-year-old woman who is or man?
Isn't that still young?
Yeah, or not so young, who is having a relationship right now, and they're questioning some of the things that are happening. What would you say, and what warning signs would you tell them to look for and to maybe pull back from this relationship and not get married and not enter into the rest of your life with this person, because it's going to be a precarious position that you're in after you're married, and the tendencies to be narcissistic become even more intense.
Yeah. You know, I did a piece in the book. I also wrote an article about the concept of self-deception. And I based it on a piece of work that Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir talked about, this whole notion of self-deception. And the example they give is the woman is at the cafe, her hand is on the table, her date of the night takes her hand. She's not interested in him at all, but she doesn't know what to do with that overture. So instead, she has a dilemma. Does she pull her hand away and break the social grace of the moment, or does she leave it there? And 9 times out of 10, because women are raised to be nice girls, they leave it there, all right? That's a tacit acceptance of that action. That's what happens in a dating situation when you go along with it. And so the signs to look for, some of them are really easy. It's a feeling in the pit of your stomach that something is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he flirting with the waitress? Why is he getting texts from his old girlfriends while I'm sitting here? Why is he belittling me in front of my friends? Why is he using put-down humor? Why did he just treat that person that way? That wasn't very kind. I wouldn't have done that. You have gut responses. Yeah.
When you talk about the waitress issue, or the wait staff, that word seems demeaning to me sometimes, but when I remember back 21, 25 years ago when I was dating my ex-husband, the very same thing happened. Very, very disrespectful to wait staff, very just inappropriate behavior. And if I would have recognized that at 19, I would have known better. But I didn't. And so if people can be aware that the way they're treating people in their surroundings is something to really watch for, I think that's a really great point.
It's a great tell. But, and then get in the car with somebody and watch them in traffic.
Great one. Yes. Fabulous.
That is a great one. Boy, oh boy. That's another show also. I want to, you have a chapter,
but thing,
and I'm going to say the name.
Thing to put in bold letters here, whatever it is that you're looking at, watch your own reaction. If your gut is telling you, gee, this feels off to me, honor it. Too many women, too many girls don't. They just don't.
Crucial point.
And I just had a case today where I was teaching her how, you know, she didn't like that all these girlfriends were involved with her boyfriend. And I said, look, you have a choice here. And she took a stand with him he got rid of all these girls, and then he told her, you know, I got a lot of respect for you because you did that, that you weren't just like everyone else. So sometimes it isn't that the guy's a bad guy. He may be unconsciously testing your mettle to see, do you stand up for yourself? Are you self-respecting? And that's really underneath all of this. If that's your guide, then you'll know. As long as you don't cover it up and look the other way, you'll know.
I'd like to talk about a really anathema, really a problematic component of the abuse cycle, and that is the woman's or the man's, whoever it is, interpretation that they get the most heartfelt apologies from the abuser. When I was an attorney, I represented a lot of abused women, a couple of abused men, but more abused women, who would tell me that nobody ever loved them so much, and it was because they loved them so much that they couldn't control their jealousy. And intensity, and then when they apologized, when the spouse apologized, it was on the knees. It was, I can't live without you. The kind of words that people live a lifetime waiting to hear, and you don't. And in normal relationships, those kind of things just don't have to come up. But it's very impassioned, and a lot of people buy into that. Talk about that.
Well, you're talking about the, even though it's not physical, you're talking about the cycle of violence, and what that is in the domestic violence lingo is there's a honeymoon period. There's a calm period in the relationship, and then there's the explosion, and then what usually follows it is a honeymoon period with all the begging and pleading and I love you and on your knees and the flowers and all of that. I have to say what's ironic in the population I studied and I work with, these guys are so entitled, they don't do the honeymoon period.
Really?
So these women are taking them back. Yeah, they're taking them back. And I hear lines like, he had enough money to take me around the world and he never even apologized. So they're not getting all of that. But in situations where you do, you know, I think it's a matter of fool me once, shame on you, but fool me twice, shame on me. How many times can you keep taking back because of that? You know, there has to be a statute of limitations on how many apologies wear thin.
Yeah.
And I think that's the guide to that. But, yes, I have heard people say that, and I think every time you take someone back after a horrible incident, you're basically reinforcing their behavior. You're telling them with your actions that it's acceptable to
right.
you. And that's,
does
that's
everybody
anyway.
Coming out of an abusive family need therapy?
I'm sorry, the music's falling.
If does everybody need therapy coming out of an abusive, not if somebody gets hit once and then leaves. Maybe that's the appropriate reaction. But if you stay, have you been degenerated in a way emotionally that you're going to need a lot of repair? What would you advise on that?
I think it never hurts to get support in that situation, whether it's formal counseling, whether it's clergy, whether it's really good friends who have walked you through it. I think support is key. I think it's what allows you to heal. A lot of the women who come to the healing retreat weekends, they have never even told their story fully to anyone ever before. So it's
Susan, do you have a healing retreat weekend coming up?
I have one coming up. Well, if people are interested, they should email me at drsusanweitzman@aol.com.
Would you spell that really slow? We have a few minutes.
Well, you know what? They could just go to the website. They could go to the website, theweitzmancenter.org. theweitzmancenter, theweitzmancenter.org. And there is a link that says contact us. If you contact us and just write in the subject area retreat, we'll send you everything about that. But
great,
so,
and that's a weekend retreat, right?
That's a 3-day weekend, and the costs are very, very minimal for what you're getting. You're getting 3 days, room and board, and doing the work and all the conference materials, and most people who've taken it have called it transformational and life-changing, and you're with other people who are like-minded. So in answer to the question, because I'm not here to hawk everybody needs therapy, I think people need support, and how you go about getting it makes a difference for how you heal. And sometimes even just having the right ear, listening to you construct the story and reconstruct the story in a way that is something you can live with is curative and is healing in nature. But yes, do people, most people, you know, fall apart from something like this? Yes, oftentimes internally, of course you do. Because look at what you've had to do. The cognitive dissonance involved with staying in an abusive situation. Here's someone you love being abusive to you. That's a disconnect. Someone you love shouldn't hurt you. Someone you love shouldn't make you cry consistently. So to live with that disconnect makes you jumbled inside at the very least. I see a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety, a lot of insomnia. What's really, really sad is how many cases I see of women who finally, after years, get out of these situations and they get diagnosed with some kind of cancer. Mm. They say there's stress related to cancer. You know, this would certainly suggest that. So, yeah, the more support you can get early on, the better. Did that answer your question pretty much?
I think that's a great answer. I think that support is so crucial to every part of this. And specifically, when I talk to people who are alienated parents, they're having a strong support system for them, because depression is intense when this happens, and sadness and heartbreak. And so having a strong support system, and in many cases, especially in the women and some men that you deal with, their family has left them, their friends have left them, their church has left them, they have nobody.
Their children have left them.
So right. So when you go to these retreats and see people that are like you, you understand you're not the only one, and
right.
you have someone as a sounding board. But boy, it is horrible to find when you turn around to look and you thought you had an army behind you, that there's
right.
no one there.
Right.
What I love about retreats is it's like 2 years of therapy.
I was just going to say
in a way that alters you. Good retreats, like I've heard about your retreat. For people who can't afford the 3 days,
exactly.
I don't mean financially, I mean for on all levels, every hospital usually has some kind of program, too, to get involved with an ongoing support group.
And also, in the back of the book, I have a list for every single state and for some countries of contacts to make, initial contacts, who can direct you to the kind of resources you might need.
You will go places and help people set up retreats, too, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. In fact, if anyone gets 6 people together, that's all we need as a minimum, I will
really?
Go do a retreat anywhere. Anywhere. I've done it out of the country. I mean, I will do that anywhere, and I can train people how to do the retreats. But I just do want to say, if anyone is in a situation where they immediately need some kind of assistance or there is some possible danger, the number to call is 1-800-799-SAFE, 799-SAFE. That is the domestic violence hotline. It's a national hotline. It's a confidential hotline, and you can just call it. And they will connect you where you need to be connected. Now, Jill mentioned the Weitzman Center. What we're doing with our new this year, one of our initiatives is to create a website that can be interactive, because sometimes people are embarrassed or they don't want to be seen or they don't want to come out about it. We're trying to create some kind of venue for people to connect with each other in the privacy of their own home. So, you know, we're looking forward to what 2011 brings with that.
I think we'd be remiss if we don't ask you to weigh in on a really important subject. The anecdote that we get in court at times is this thing called anger management classes. And it's often used as a panacea in abusive relationships. Weigh in. Does it work? What do you think? I have seen it. I've seen it work. So what do you think?
Well, you heard my first reaction that was spontaneous when you said it, right? I chuckled.
No, I didn't. I mean, I didn't. I missed it. What did you do?
She chuckled.
I chuckled because it is a little bit like, you know, liver spot cream sometimes. Use this and it'll work. You know, I've worked with men who've done anger management, who've done it repeatedly even, and they really haven't gotten at the root of the issue. It depends on the anger management class. It depends on the man. The biggest indicator of what's going to reflect change in the abuser is the consequences. If the consequences are severe enough, you're going to see change. If they aren't, you're not going to. For some guys, going to anger management classes, like me going to safety school after I've done 10 miles an hour over the limit, you go through it and you just get it over with. So it really depends. Sometimes it works. There are some programs. Minnesota has some amazing programs. It depends. I don't think it's a panacea.
Okay.
No. No.
No, no, not a panacea. I'm just saying it's a tool. It's just
it can
a tool.
Be a great tool. It can be a great tool. It depends on the hands, you know, who you're in, what group you're in,
and
how you got there.
And finally, unless Jill has a question, maybe you'll like this question, Jill. I think you will.
Okay.
Could you weigh in a little bit, Dr. Weissman, on a lot of times the clergy will advise people that they need to stay together.
Right.
Because they can't help it. It's the doctrine. And I don't fault that in any way. But what about our listeners who are going to feel guilty for leaving? And you must deal with this all the time because the clergy is saying, this is your family, this is God's will.
Not all clergy. Not all clergy.
Of course not. I'm talking about those that are telling that message. Of course.
Well, what I was
going to
say was I gave a talk to a group in Indiana of clergy who are really opening their minds to the whole thing. I think you have to weigh it all out yourself in terms of, there are people who don't want to get divorced if they're Catholic because it means they're going to be excommunicated. What if they don't get an annulment? You have to weigh everything out and see which is the worst guilt. Watching your kids become incapable of relationships because of what they watched you go through, is that worse than having your church say you're a bad girl? You've got to weigh that out. It's such a personal decision. And the only part I can strongly say is I don't think it's right for anyone to tell someone to stay only because of a doctrine without looking at the situation. Mm-hmm. If that situation could be deadly and they're saying, but stay and pray over it, I take issue with that. And I've seen
and
it.
I
love
your that answer.
Of guilt. Just another show to prove, first you get the test, then you get the lesson.
That's right. We've got about
the school.
Yeah. We've got about 3 minutes left, and I just want to cover a couple of things before we go. And this has been such an insightful and wonderful show with Dr. Weissman, and I think we've had some really good, healthy debate. I wanted to point out your book, Susan, which you've mentioned 100,000 times, but let's talk about Not to People Like Us, Hidden Abuse in Upscale Marriages, your book, of course, and what an outstanding tool. And as I look through my copy, all of the red marks all through this book and all of the indicators of what happened to me, and I think it's a very, very helpful tool. And where is that available?
Everywhere. And if
everywhere.
Stock, yeah, well, yeah, sure, Barnes & Noble. I mean,
good.
Any bookstore, online, Amazon.
Good.
You can get used copies much cheaper these days, too. So, and if any bookstore doesn't have it, you could just ask them to order it. So I think it's in its fourth printing or something. So it's
great.
Available everywhere.
Great. And, of course, Michelle's book, which could go really hand-in-hand, The Good Karma Divorce, which is a wonderful tool for anyone contemplating divorce, going through divorce, after divorce, anyone in a conflict. It is such a great book, again, available in all of those outlets. And my book, The Look of Love, which is a novel about divorce and parental alienation. So three girls with three books and trying to make the world better one book at a time, you know, as we kind of work our way through this system that has just become so strange for families in America today and all over the world. And I'd like to thank Susan for taking her time from her busy family. She has such beautiful little children and being with us here tonight. And if anybody needs to get a hold of her, the WeissmanCenter.org, right?
Right. And there's also, they could also go to, if they don't remember that, www.nottopeoplelikeus.com. Hit the contact us list. I'll get back to everybody.
Great. Sounds good. She'll get back to you. So if you have any questions, Michelle, you take care of yourself and keep doing
what
you're doing.
Thank you, and thanks to our listeners for tuning in. And if you have any topics you'd like to hear about it, please let us know.
Absolutely.
We'll
let us know. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll see you 2 weeks from tonight with our guest, and we'll let you know who that's going to be soon. Thank you for tuning in. Have a great week.
Hi, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye.